This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, our schools, are we ready to open them? That's the discussion of the hour. I will acknowledge freely this. We're taping this on Thursday. This afternoon, the governor is going to have some sort of an announcement. May or may not change the rules a little bit, but unlikely to change the underlying dilemma that kids have been out of school for 6 months. On the other hand, there is a pandemic, and there are those who have argued that opening the schools in their traditional format would be akin to throwing into a petri dish of disease. We have three key players in this decision with us this morning. Dr. Donna Lewis is superintendent of the Creighton Elementary School District. She's also the president of the Arizona School Administrators, and therefore, I believe, as I understand it, speaks for administrators. I would assume that would be administrators, superintendents, principals, and the like. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to the show. Chris Cotterman, Government Relations Director of the Arizona School Boards Association. You speak for the governing boards. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And Joe Thomas, President of the Arizona Education Association. I'm a speaker, as you can, I guess, on behalf of the teachers. Welcome to the Think Tank.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, I'd like to start out with Chris, just because your organization, the Arizona School Boards Association, has issued a letter to the governor outlining what you think are the criteria that should be met before the schools can open. And that traditionally in this state, the schools open about 2 weeks from now. I believe the governor pushed that back by a week, which, of course, doesn't change anything very much. But a lot of it seems to be in flux. Tell us what criteria did you set forth?
Well, in our letter, the main point that we made was that opening of schools should not be based on a date. It should be based on how severe the spread of the coronavirus is in the community. And the CDC, in conjunction with the White House, even the president had his plan for opening up America again. And under that plan, in phase two, the CDC says when you meet the criteria for phase two is when schools might consider reopening. And that is generally about a month's worth of declining cases in declining new cases, a decrease in percent positive cases, and the wide availability in testing such that you can get a test result in less than 3 days. And that's not a set in stone number. Obviously, we didn't say do this or nothing, but our biggest point to the governor is we have to have public health officials tell us when it is safe to have students back in buildings with staff and other community members, because school district officials can make all the educational decisions they need to make, but they're not public health officials, and they need to know when they can come back to school without putting their students and staff at risk. And so that's the basic thrust of our letter. We would like the governor, Department of Health Services, county health officials, we don't really care who, but someone who with a background in public health to say, at this point in this, we're confident that the spread of disease in the community is known to us, and we think that it is safe to come back to in-person instruction in some forms.
Donna Lewis, you're president of the Arizona School Administrators. Whose decision is this?
Well, I'm going to completely align with everything Chris just said. The Arizona School Administrators have sent a letter to Governor Ducey and to Superintendent Hoffman requesting metrics for those decisions. And I don't blame them a bit for being reluctant or hesitant or trying to gather all the information they can, because the needle keeps moving on how we know the spread of the virus continues. So the question is, how dangerous is it for children and teachers to be gathered in large mass groups called a school that would be endangering? We want our kids back in person more than anybody. We want to be with them. We know the organic nature and the social needs and the emotional needs of kids is based on physical attendance. There's no reluctance whatsoever on the desire to be back in school. There's just clearly a focus on safety first before we do so. So districts are grappling with a state delay and a decision on whether they're going to open or not. So there are different districts choosing different dates.
So can the governor order that you go back to school August 10th or 5th or any other date? Can the governor specify a date you must go back to school? Or can the governor, on the other hand, could the governor say no in-person school till January 1? Does the governor have that authority in either direction?
Yeah, through executive order, he has a authority to make a declaration. And then local school boards can operate around that declaration. So the executive order does give him, in an emergency case, authority, although it is a state legislator practice.
So,
and Mike, I'm sorry, on this point, this is Chris Cotterman with ASBA again. I think the big point here is that the governor has leverage in the sense that he is controlling a pot of money that is being used to supplement school budgets. So he can impose conditions on that money to get us to do things, which is, you know, appropriate. I mean, he's the executive. He's in control of the money. But the issue here is he has said he can't tell us, I don't believe, when we have to open by. We have some instructional requirements around, you know, the funding formula, which we have to abide by. But the way that he's exercising some influence here is he's saying that when you start in-person instruction, when you start instruction by the date that I fix, you have to have an option for students to attend for free on-site learning in order to qualify for this money. So that's sort of a wrinkle that we're dealing with. So in effect, when he says we have to be able to in some way put students back in the classroom in a limited fashion, and so that's how he's sort of exercising the authority here.
So clearly you can't function without that money. So if he can hold up money that is absolutely essential to you, then he can, in effect, through that mechanism, he basically can impose his judgment on it. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, in this case, I mean, if there's a district that's willing to take a 5 to 15% haircut on their funding, they can do whatever they want. But
on this planet.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and that applies in either direction. I mean, up to this point, what the governor has done has been so minimal. He's pushed things back by a week. And what I'm hearing from, I think, all of you, and Joe hasn't spoken up, but I don't expect him to disagree. I think the gist of what I've heard from you so far is you're more prone to push things back than move things forward right now.
Mike, this is Joe with the Arizona Education Association. What I think we all want to move forward on is having a safe state again. And so we need to move forward on social distancing and wearing masks and washing our hands multiple times a day to where the entire society is safe again. When we get those numbers down around the COVID testing cases and the number of people that are in hospitals, there is a federal plan around reopening America. And that's what these metrics all push us towards. We need to see about 4 consecutive weeks of a downward trend across 6 different metrics. And those are, I'm sure, some of the very same metrics that both ASA and ASBA are saying the governor needs to pay attention to and use as targets for us, to where we can then reopen our schools. And at that point, we still have to adopt social distancing.
If
I agree with Superintendent Lewis. Educators want to be in the classroom. That's where we do our most work, our best work. That's where we know our students learn the best. But we cannot end up taking a gigantic step backwards by reopening our schools too soon, just like we reopened the state too soon, and have the spread of this virus spike again. And this time it would spike all over the state because we have schools in every single community. We have to remember this is a health crisis first. Then we address the economy. Then we address schools.
We'll be back in just a moment with Donna Lewis, who's superintendent of Creighton Elementary School District and president of the Arizona School Administrators, Chris Cotterman, who's with the Arizona State School Boards Association, and Joe Thomas, president of the Arizona Education Association, representing the teachers. When we return, talking about opening our schools in the think tank after the break.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with 3 of the educational leaders of the state. Donna Lewis speaks for the administrators. She's president of the Arizona School Administrators. Chris Cotterman, who's Government Relations Director for Arizona School Boards Association, and Joe Thomas, President of the Arizona Education Association, representing the teachers. I want to throw this out to all of you. You've mentioned that there's criteria that you want the governor to adhere to. And what I heard was this included a 4-week drop in certain metrics, such as the numbers of new cases. The last time I looked at those numbers, it's not at all clear that we've had any drop, or we've been in the, 2 weeks ago, we were in a spike upwards. And from what I looks to me right now, over the last week or so, it's difficult to say because it's short term, but it looks like we've at best plateaued. So if I were to tell me if you think I have that wrong, but if not, then the implication is even if we turn things around right away, we shouldn't open our schools for at least a month from now.
This is Joe. I would agree with that. I think that any of the changes that we make, any of the changes that the governor unveils later today, they typically take a week or two for those new behaviors to show up in an impact on testing. And then if we adhere to the White House's plan for reopening America again, we're looking at 4 weeks after that. And that's if we're perfect. And Arizona did a great job last spring. We had 5 good weeks where we really suppressed the spread. We took it very seriously. And then we had protests that people wanted to have their hair cut and different things. And we reopened the state and we ended up spiking. So if we take this seriously, if we want our schools to be open for in-person instruction, then we will take this seriously and we will all contribute to that and we'll be able to reopen our schools. But I don't think it's going to happen in the first quarter. I hope I'm wrong, but I just think the first 9 weeks is really going to be spent online and in remote learning. And if we can get that plan out, the boards and the superintendents can implement it. The educators, the classroom teachers, the counselors, everybody can then find their place in that plan and we can have quality instruction. But as we keep moving around with an uncertain future, it becomes very difficult for people to plan beyond just a week or two out.
Let me just point after, I don't want to do in this segment because it's going to take some time. I want to devote our third segment to what is online learning look like and how are we prepared for that. But I do want to make one comment as somebody spent his life doing and trying to communicate data to people. One of the great difficulties of this is if you look at the data and you look at the behaviors, there is a perfect relationship. But the problem in communicating it is that there's a 2-week lag. So as you pointed out, we did a great job. We kept everything suppressed. Then there was an opening. The governor said, we're going to open up things. And I think he blew it in terms of what he should have said is, I'm removing the legal prohibitions, but people should still wear a mask and be very careful about what your behavior. I think the way that message went out is, whoa, it's over. Go out and party. And we saw the crowds in Scottsdale. We saw the I want to get my haircut demonstrations. We saw all of that. And there was not an immediate spike. There's a spike 2 weeks later. And that's much harder to see. We've seen this in several other cases as well. We see the behavior change. So when you recloister people, it doesn't go down immediately. There's a 2-week lag. And it's more difficult for people to appreciate the connection between their behavior and the result when there's a 2-week lag.
Well, and there seems to be a myth about the ability of children to be contributors to the spread. And so there's some studies coming out from South Korea that high school and middle schoolers spread equally to the same way in which adults spread. Mm-hmm. We don't have information or data on how the little guys spread. So there's a myth that, well, then they don't spread it. Well, being a asymptomatic carrier is still a threat to other children and families when we're 30 kids per 900 square feet. And if we're asked to distance learn 6 feet apart, we're maybe able, if everybody stays real still with masks and the shields, to put 15 kids in a classroom. So we're really thinking about the ability of our staff to successfully monitor children and lead them in learning in these environments that are so rigid and safe.
You know, that 15 in a class, that stuck in my head. I was down in Mexico and I was talking to an elementary school teacher there. And what they're going to do, I think for them, the idea of internet-based stuff is out of the question. They just don't have the resources. But what they're doing is schools every other day, and they put a cap on 15 in a classroom. And, you know, and this, we're talking about under-resourced schools. They're at a, at a different level completely from what we're at.
And Mike, I just want to underscore too the point. I mean, when we talk about going back, we're talking about going back in that limited fashion, because people want to get back to normal. And I think that that's an understandable impulse, but it's even more important that we need to understand how this thing is spreading the community, and that we have a decent handle on it. Because if you want to spike cases in rural Arizona, you know, I challenge you to find a better way than packing the dome in Round Valley from people all across northern Arizona for a high school football game, and then sending them back to their communities. I mean, schools have events all the time that are outside of classroom instruction, and that's really what people enjoy about schools a lot of times. And those are probably the riskiest things that we can do right now. So when we talk about going back, quote unquote, we're talking about offering instruction in a in-person setting in a physically distance responsible way. It's going to be a minute.
We will talk about that, and we will talk about what distance learning might look like when we return with our panel of educators in the think tank.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are talking about opening our schools, when, where, how. Donna Lewis speaks for the administrators, superintendents, and principals as president of the Arizona Association of School Administrators. Chris Cotterman is with the Arizona School Boards Association. Joe Thomas, president of the AEA, Arizona Education Association, representing the teachers. Because you're closest to the teachers, I want to ask this of you, Joe. When the kids come back, whether it be online entirely or mixed breed or in classroom, what does school look like in this upcoming year?
Well, it's going to look a lot different depending on what model that we use. And it's going to be very different than the spring. I think that's the first thing parents need to understand is we had to adopt a really important rule last spring when we turned on a dime during spring break and came back in. And we said that you could only improve your grades if you were a student. And I was 15 once, and I could play that system pretty well. If I had all my grades in, I probably wasn't going to give up playing Fortnite to go and be in a social studies classroom. And that phenomenon existed. It didn't at first, but it became to where educators were very frustrated. They didn't have their students. But we needed to extend that grace during that fourth quarter. We didn't want to harm our students because some of them didn't have the technology. What'll be different this year is we've had a little bit more time to plan, although it is frustrating that we don't have a solid plan from the governor that then the boards and the superintendents can give better guidance around timelines to the teachers. But we have had a little bit more time to plan. We've rolled out a little bit more technology, and grades will be counted. And we still have to be careful about overwhelming students. I don't know that we're going to have 6 hours of screen time for first graders. I think that's detrimental. But we're going to do the best job we can. And I think all levels of us have to be communicating with parents so they have clear expectations of how they can be an effective a support mechanism for their students and how we can listen to them. If it becomes where we're starting to move students back in small groups or almost everybody, it's probably going to be an A, B cohort situation or a half day situation at first.
Meaning splitting classes in half.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I meant. We need to ease back into it. And maybe the lower level first. I mean, there'll be a lot of decisions that are made in the districts, but we have to ease into it to make sure that we're not moving too fast and we end up with spread again. But I think the biggest difference is around the accountability around grades, and that we learned a lot last quarter that we're going to implement this quarter.
It's sort of like you say, if everybody's as a guaranteed A, it's pretty hard to motivate kids to work.
I think we could all play that system pretty well.
I want to ask this question of Donna, but only because I think you might be best equipped to answer, but please, anybody jump in. All of these distance learning models assume at some level that every kid has a screen and access to the internet. Are we there? What have we done? What do we have to do to pull that off?
Well, many districts are scrambling to get more iPads and laptops and distribute devices to one-to-one for students. And it's been a miracle how we've been able to work with the companies and the procurement process to get those out into the hands. We're deploying devices in my district as we speak. Hundreds a day. And the parents are so appreciative because parents are our critical partner. And many parents since the spring have made a reprioritization of limited funds to purchase hotspots or internet capacity that in the spring we had 30% of our families unable or not at that level yet.
So 30, that's the baseline. 30% couldn't do it in the spring.
Yes, roughly. And okay. And that's a conservative number. But I will tell you, we've seen an improvement just by personal choice and reprioritization of funding. And the cities, Phoenix is working with business partners to find a way to make internet affordable. And everybody's trying to step up and lean in to help families get these hotspots. We even have them on buses. If we go park the buses in the neighborhood, we can get them into some of our homes. So we're really working on trying to close that gap.
Have the providers been helpful in that? I wondered if you couldn't put the arm to a Cox or to a Verizon to say, for those people below a certain income level, provide them with the base level of service. Do you have any of that?
Absolutely. We're completely grateful to those companies for reducing their rates. We've got some as low as $25 a month for internet access. And then our partnering district in Phoenix is actually putting out for our high school students spots so our siblings are able to get access to that. So we're partnering on many, many levels fast.
So what would you estimate if it was 30% couldn't access internet? Access means two things. It means a screen and it means a pipeline. If that number was 30% last spring, where do you think we are right now?
My best guess would be we're probably at 85 to 90% capacity of people having access. Okay. But we're providing them places in the school because we have access. And if they'll drop their kid off and we can find a safe place, and I'm not saying any given district, but selected places where they can get access, we're partnering through our parent liaisons and working with individual parents one by one on where can you go and how can we help, even with childcare centers that are open.
I'd like to go maybe back to Joe on this. How low can I'm fine with this for high school kids, but I'm wondering in the lower grades, how much, what can you do with a first grader?
Well, I think that's where we're going to have to lean into the creativity of our educators. I learned a lot out of Sesame Street. Now, that was a pretty well-researched and produced show. And
that was a multi-million dollar budget, too.
Yeah. Well, and we'll have educators that will be able to put things together that will approach some of that teaching and learning. There are a lot of professional development opportunities that are out there for educators. And that's the third thing that we need. You talked about having the devices and having the bandwidth, but we also have to have educators that are really schooled in how to chunk the lesson plan, how to break it down in a way that is digestible for the students. And the students have to know how to use those devices as well. So there's a lot of learning that goes on, but you're absolutely right. The idea of a distance learning is easier on my end. I taught seniors in high school than it is for kindergartners and first graders. They do figure things out pretty well, but we're going to have to walk through this very deliberately. And remember, in all of this, we're trying to balance out what's best for the students around safety and their education. I know teachers can and educators can be creative. We just have to have the resources to back that creativity up. And if it truly is the mental health and the educational well-being of our students that we're all focused on, then we need to let those dollars flow in with accountability, get them to the boards, down to the superintendents, down to the classroom, to where we can make sure that every kid has the best educational opportunities they can during this pandemic. And we can't forget that. We are in a pandemic and we're able to do this.
What is being done? What the teachers, you know, just all of a sudden to say, okay, go online now. It seems to me there's stuff that doesn't translate, that a lot of things have to be rethunk. What resources or training or what kind of help are the teachers getting other than here, okay, now just go online?
Well, we're providing social emotional training so that they have actual check-ins and how are you doing and how is this pandemic for you? And as much as we really value and need and focus on the teaching of reading and math and social studies and science, we've got to have our kids emotionally with us and well. And we know this pandemic has been traumatic for lack of hugs or smiles or the reading of body language that we get in the dynamics of a of a more organic classroom. So, you know, we're spending a ton of time, again, with parents as our partners, because we want our parents as our associate teachers helping us motivate children. We have parents saying to us, my kid won't. I need you to get online and tell him too. So it's interesting, this dynamic of children's will. And so how do we make it so inviting, like Sesame Street, like Joe brought up? We've got to make this so inviting that kids want to be with their friends online. They want to laugh and play online. And that's new for us, because we've had that so naturally in the normal classroom of the past.
Yeah, the social aspects of school are huge. And it's very easy to see that being lost.
Well, I'm sorry, Mike.
No, go ahead.
Some of what will be delivered online will also be assignments that can be done in the home, that can be done with parents or independently. A lot of enrichment activities that then you come back and you talk about with your classmates, or you present what that is. And so that's one way that we can move away from just screen time to where we really can do some more hands-on approaches. And that's really important for some of our students that don't always get enough of that, especially in the junior high and the high school levels. We are really going to be learning a lot about how to teach online as we do it, in the same way that we are learning about a virus that is brand new and that's impacting every nation on the globe. We're learning about it as we go. There's a lot of research and a lot of good professional development about how to educate online. I don't know that too many places have really researched it in the amount that we're about to do, to where it is going to be all we're going to be doing for several weeks. But we're going to, educators are masters at monitoring and adjusting, stealing good ideas from each other. And so what has to happen is some space for that collaborative professional development where we can learn from each other. And this really becomes important both at the superintendency level, the administrative level, and the governing board level of reprioritizing the funding that we get, you know, what funding we do get from the state to put in place the time and space for educators to learn from each other. And the boards will have to lead on that. And I do think that's something that Chris and his group of school boards will want to see in our schools. They want to support educators like that.
We'll be back in a concluding section with our panel of educators when we return in just a moment in the think tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with our panel of educators talking about what happens with our schools when they open. There's a question. I think the consensus here was it's way early right now, at least to be in person, that there's going to be some level of distance learning. I want to ask... I think Donna, but the other views, I thought you said you think we're up to, you know, 85% of students maybe who have internet access, who actually have screen and internet access. Well, that's a nice high number, but not if you're in the 15%. What needs to be done to get that number up to universal?
Well, I certainly hope that we could create internet as a fundamental utility. And I think that's a big metropolitan goal for us. And I think it's at fastest 18 months if we're all aggressive about it. In the meantime, we're going to cope with good old fashioned packets and reaching out and finding ways to pair up families with other families, mm-hmm. and that feel safe and tested to be with one another. So yeah, we need to really look at citywide solutions for access.
I'm also envisioning that tech support. I think you're might get into some hiring issues of, you know, some kids at home and the computer, something goes wrong with it. They don't know what to, they're going to need some access to tech support, or you're going to be in trouble, because you can have the computer and internet, but all of a sudden it gets, you know, we've all had this situation. I had a tech guy for many, many years and something stopped working and I just said, here, fix it. some semblance of that, or else you get knocked offline, you're out of school basically.
Yeah.
Well, I think Mike, I think the one of the interesting things about this is that we could learn a little bit from, we do have online charters in this, and online schools in this state. who have been doing this for a while, not this same way. I think that's for a very specific type of student, but they have sort of dealt with some of those issues. I think, but the big thing is, yeah, it's an interesting thing. If there's a good thing that's come out of this, it's this idea that, you know, we as education advocates have been saying for years that the digital divide, the homework gap, is a big equity problem that is laying beneath the surface and it needs to be dealt with. And the way that we've historically dealt with that from a policy level is to make internet available at school. If you don't have it at home, you can get it at school. Well, now school is closed, so you can't get it at school. And so it unearths this problem that we all have acknowledged for a long time, but now it's being laid bare for everybody to see. And it's going to require a little bit of reevaluation. Don is absolutely right, between different governmental entities, because if internet is a public good, if it should be a public utility that everybody has access to, then cities, towns, counties, school districts all have to work together on this, and we haven't been doing that. And this is the result. So hopefully this serves as the wake-up call that this is a big deal that we need to get with. And school districts can modify. Maybe they do a contract help desk for or something like that if they have resources for that. So we can work this out, but we have to first acknowledge that it's a problem and, you know, sort of set our nose to the grindstone, as it were.
Yeah, it's 21st century. That may be as necessary as air conditioning to be able to fully function in this environment. I want to explore with all of you, though, sort of the unintended consequences of this. You know, a fair hit on education is that a lot of our education system is based on an 18th century agrarian model. That's why we have summers off. And that to a very great extent, there's a lot of things that haven't changed in many, many years. Does this force us to rethink how education can be delivered?
Well, I can tell you that in our partnership with parents, we're learning that our parents have said, I can help my kid better at night. And we just kind of shook our head because our whole paradigm was messed with. So we asked our parents, how many would like AM? How many would like afternoon? How many would like evening? And it was an amazing result. We literally had 30, 30, 30. Well, that threw us off in our teacher culture because that was not the plan. So we're looking
plan
at
plan is
ways.
You work 8 to 4.
That's right. That's what we know. And so this is a real shift for us. And then the same thing with, you know, well, we start in the fall and we end in the spring. There's no magic to not teaching and learning in the summer. So there's all sorts of people looking at modified calendars or what used to be called year-round calendars. So lots of different uses of time as an unintended benefit.
And we need to remember that if we moved to a different schedule, you know, we're funded for 180, 185 days. Mm-hmm. And if we move to including 2, 4, 6 more weeks, I know a lot of educators that would love to do that.
Yeah.
But we have to pay them. And it would be year-round school would be about a 15 to 20% raise, and the state's not going to be able to fund that. So it's, you know, we funded schools on the cheap for a long time in Arizona, and we're beginning to see what that looks like when we're in crisis. I remember I grew up in Oklahoma, very rural schools, and we still had the best technology, better technology at school than I had in my home, right? I had an 8-track player. That was the top end of my technology at home. But in school, you had all sorts of other technologies that you were introduced to, and we don't have that anymore. The at school and now portable, because that's how a lot of technology is delivered. Our schools should be filled with the best technology for students to experience and build a skill set around. We should be able to deliver more of our content through technology, and some districts are ahead of others on this, but it should be universal, and we're seeing that it's not. And that there are real inequities in this system, and we have an opportunity to address that. And it really wouldn't be that expensive relative to the benefits that we would get out of it, with students have a fluid understanding and experience around technology from the youngest grades all the way to the end of their K-12 experience. And then they move right into the workforce, right into education, right into the trades, and they are steeped in technology.
And we're hearing from businesses
ethical use of technology. That's what we could be looking at right now. If we can get out of this survival mode and we can get a plan in front of us that is supported.
We're hearing a big shift in the workforce too, who are realizing that real estate for work may not be a needed expense, and that our business partners would like to see more educational capacity in this form of communication. So it really is another potential shift for the whole of society.
We got just a tad over a minute left. I want to ask a question of you, Joe, as a representative of the teachers. Are you satisfied that teachers are being listened to adequately in the response to this crisis?
Well, AEA has 20,000 members across the state, and we're classroom teachers, but we're also custodians and bus drivers and school nurses, anybody that works in a school. And we do fight and really advocate for our students to have conversations. And it really depends on the district and the governing board. On the whole, I would say most of the conversations are happening, but we need to all be talking and listening to each other. And we need to bring parents into these conversations as much as possible. And students. Students always get left out. Students have to do this as well. But we all need to bring our perspectives in, and then we can figure out the best way that we can meet everyone's essential needs and move forward a great educational opportunity.
Chris, you've been sort of left out here a little bit. I want to give you the last word.
Yeah, I think that everything, I mean, districts have been going as fast as they can. We're deliberative bodies, but we try to include staff and parents. Again, some predictability on metrics for reopening will do a lot to get us out of survival mode, as Joe said, and get us into proactive planning mode. I think that's really important.
Okay. I want to thank you all. Donna Lewis, Chris Cotterman, and Joe Thomas. It's been a great panel. I guess I'd like to express just a little bit of hope that that somewhere in this disaster, there is some good benefit, that we think creatively about how we approach education. And sometimes crisis begets opportunity. Thank you all. We'll see you next week on another topic in the Think Tank.